start that. I didn't need correcting.
Shut up! Order!
Order! Let's start off as we need to go on.
We can see a better future.
So it's not a competition who can shout the loudest.
Hello and welcome to the Left Wingers in Conversation With. I'm Brandon.
And I'm Kathleen. Today we are in conversation with Wes Streeting. He's the MP for Ilford North and he's been recently appointed as Shadow Secretary of State for Child Poverty.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Wes. Okay, so we're going to start off as we mean to go on, really. And in the next week, we've got the conference coming up. We're all excited about it. Sure that you're excited about it. But one thing that we want to know is, what is your go-to karaoke song?
Yeah, my go-to karaoke song is... I've got quite a few because I love karaoke. I guess the one that I go to the most is Don't Let the Sun Go Down on Me by George Michael and Elton John. And it's always good if you can find a partner who can sing well enough. Because I'm not a great singer, but someone who can sing well enough to pull it off and really give that song the performance it deserves. And I'll be honest, over the years, I've had some reliable karaoke partners and some less reliable ones on that song. And it's always disappointing when someone says, yeah, I can sing it. And then you get into it and you think, no, you're killing Elton John's part and it's upsetting. And I probably shouldn't say this on a Left Wingers podcast, but actually... probably the best karaoke partner I've had on this song is Will Quince, who's the unfortunately he's a Tory MP for Colchester and he's a new children's minister, so actually someone I'm going to be crossing swords with now, even though I've known him for quite a long time. But yeah, good at karaoke, less good at policies, but good at karaoke.
Yeah, less good at the policy, I guess, is the problematic part of that friendship. it's all right, sometimes we all have friends that are conservatives. You know, no one's perfect.
Someone's got to.
Yeah, no one's perfect. We all have our flaws, Wes. Anyway, so let's kick off. Thank you, of course, for being with us today. We realise that you are really busy. So what was your journey into politics and how did your upbringing and where you came from and your story affect your politics and who you are as an MP today?
Yeah, I guess those are two quite big questions. In terms of my journey into politics, I mean, it is inseparable from my upbringing in a way. I mean, I joined the Labour Party when I was 15, back in 1998. So we were just into, in fact, wasn't even yet the first anniversary of the new Labour government that had come in 1997. And I'd already decided I was Labour. I felt pretty inspired by the 97 general election campaign. And it's hard to kind of capture in words really the sense of excitement that existed in the country at the time, and it literally felt like the sun was shining, you know, the country was optimistic and upbeat, and there was real kind of, you know, real change in the air. And I'd already started to campaign for the Labour Party and volunteer before I joined. In fact, I stood as the school mock election candidate for the Labour Party in 1997 and came a very respectable second to the monster raving loony party in my school. But my kind of Labour values and politics are definitely informed by my upbringing. You know, as lots of people listening will know, but maybe some won't, you know, I come from a very working class background. My parents were both very young when they had me. My mum was 18, about to turn 19. My dad was 17, about to turn 18. And I think I'm sort of what's technically described as an accident. I was not a planned arrival. And my parents' relationship didn't last and they separated. So my mum was a, you know, lone parent. I mean, I always had my dad in my life. And actually, you know, I lived with my dad throughout most of my secondary education. I lived with my mum throughout primary school. But it was pretty difficult, especially for my mum being a single mum in the 1980s. And it was difficult because of the stigma that existed towards single mums back then, especially young mums. It was difficult for her because, very much like today, although I think on lots of levels it's worse now, the kind of the financial support was appalling. And my mum had to try and hold down all sorts of jobs to try and sort of, you know, while she was sort of raising me on her own. And you know, things were very difficult and we grew up in a very poor household and we were reliant on the benefit system to put food in the fridge and money in the electric meter. And, you know, it felt to me, and the single parent bit's important. I remember when I was in secondary school, hearing Anne Widdecombe give some interview where she'd sort of trashed single mums. And it felt like a very personal attack on me and my family. And I just sort of grew up with this sense that the Tories aren't for people like me. The Labour Party is. And yeah, I haven't really looked back since. I've wobbled a couple of times. I left the Labour Party briefly over Iraq and tuition fees when I was at university. And a friend of mine who was a couple of years older and was still a Labour Party member said, you know, what are you doing that for? Don't be so bloody stupid. You know, it's Labour versus the Tories. And, you know, if you don't like the direction of the Labour Party, you've got to get involved and try and influence things from inside. And so I rejoined the Labour Party. And I'm glad I did, because in terms of, you know, my kind of ongoing involvement in the Labour Party, I got very involved in Labour students when I was involved in NUS and student politics. Stood for my local council and became deputy leader of Redbridge Council. And when Ilford North selection came up, it was my local seat. It was 83rd on Ed Miliband's 106 strong target list. I thought, well, if anyone can win it, I can. I've got local roots, a profile and a platform as deputy leader of the council to take on an incumbent that had been there for 10 years. And I knew it was going to be a challenging seat. But, you know, given the result back in 2015, where we lost a huge number of seats, we got the largest swing from Labour to the Conservatives in the country. And I won, even though there are people who were in the sort of top 10 targets who lost. So I learned a lot about winning elections over the last sort of 15 years or so, particularly winning seats from the Tories, which I did on the council and in Parliament. And that's probably quite a useful experience, because we've got to win a hell of a lot more seats from the Tories to win the next general election.
So I just want to pick up on one of the little things that you said, actually, in your answer to that question. You talked about the brief stint in which you left the party, and one of the things which you said that it's because you kind of felt like you couldn't affect the change that you wanted to see within the party. How do you think the leadership could be better at listening to young people in the party and making them feel empowered?
Yeah, it wasn't so much that I didn't feel listened to back then. It was more I just sort of threw my toys out the pram, really, and just thought, well, these are two things that I really care about. And, you know, on the tuition fees, but I thought we were breaking a manifesto commitment, and that just seemed to me to be wrong. And I didn't and still don't agree with what we did in terms of tuition fees as a way of funding higher education anyway. But there is something about kind of being more involved in the party. You know, I'm proud of the fact that Labour's a democratic party. I'm proud of the fact that we have members shaping policy. And although it doesn't always make for completely seamless television when people look in at our conference floor and some of the debates that we've had in the past and no doubt we'll have next week, I think it's good that our conference is a real political conference where you'll get delegates from across the country, from the trade unions and the socialist societies debating issues. And there'll be people who stand up and say, oh, I don't like this, or, you know, I want this or I want that to change. But that's much better than kind of the stage managed set pieces that we'd see at the Conservative Party conference. I think we've got to do a lot more on kind of the youth and student sections of the party to make young people feel welcome, included, and to give them an outlet to have a say over the direction of party policy. I was really disappointed when Labour students was shut down, and I'm glad to see that it's kind of making a comeback, and hopefully we'll make a comeback in a way that is democratic and inclusive and makes people want to be involved in the student organisation. With Young Labour, there's definitely a kind of cultural challenge, I think, in Young Labour. And when I've kind of gone around speaking to Young Labour groups, it does feel that sometimes, you know, factional politics can be a bit exclusive. And I don't say that simply to bash factions, because actually, I don't think factions are inherently a bad thing. I think it's legitimate in a political party. There'll be people with different perspectives and viewpoints and coming from different ideological traditions within the party. And that's okay. And I think that can be quite healthy in terms of political debate. But I think it's also true that every level of the party, but particularly in the youth and student sections, there are lots of people who join the Labour Party without necessarily feeling like they come from a political tradition of one kind or another, and they're still learning and finding their way. And so I think if you're the sort of person who's joined the Labour Party and at the same time have already signed up to Momentum and the World Transformed, or you've already got yourself onto Luke Akers' mailing list and, you know, you're involved in Labour to Win, you're probably finding lots of like-minded people and feeling quite involved and finding it quite easy to get involved. But if you're someone who's just joined because you want to support the Labour Party, and then you turn up to a meeting and you see these different tribes kind of having it out, that can actually feel a bit exclusive. And that's the feedback I've been getting from some young members. So I think all of us have got a responsibility to think about how we can kind of change that culture and just make sure that people are included. And also, I think we've got to learn to disagree a bit better in the Labour Party as well. And it does feel like there is a bit of a culture that if you're 100% in agreement, you're on, you know, you're a friend. But at the moment, you kind of deviate from what one group or another thinks, it's like immediately cancelled, and that we that's not a good thing. So I think some of this is about structures and processes, but some of it is also about creating a welcoming and inclusive culture for everyone as well. And by the way, the final thing I'd just say is that people change. You know, I always make people laugh because when I first joined the Labour Party, John Cryer was my MP in Hornchurch at the time. And I went along to a CLP meeting, and we had this really great speaker who was on the left of the Parliamentary Labour Party. And I thought was very interesting. I agreed with what he said and signed up to Socialist Campaign Group News, which is the campaign group's kind of newspaper. And that speaker was Jeremy Corbyn. And it's fair to say that, you know, back then I was probably more of a young Corbynista than I am now. But it just goes to show that, you know, political debate, discussion, political education, it is a journey. And not all of us arrived in the Labour Party with kind of really set views about things. And we learn from debating and talking to each other. And actually, when we do, I think we find we like each other a bit more than sometimes the divisions in the media give the impression.
I guess building on from that, you said in your previous answer, you know, you got stuck in and you heard Jeremy Corbyn, you thought he was great. But now, of course, you've been labelled as this up and coming right wing MP who's, you know, taken us back to Blairism. And maybe you're not either, and maybe you're both. But how in a party that consistently wants to put labels onto people, what do you think you are? Where do you think you sit in terms of, you know, if Jeremy Corbyn sits on one side of a fence and Tony Blair and Peter Mandelson sit on the other? Do you think that you actually sit on your own and on some issues you're one way, on some issues you're another, or do you very much sit now on the kind of on the right?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. I mean, we're not all, I mean, I definitely sometimes read what people would say on social media and think I don't really recognise this caricature of a person. I mean, I'm definitely not right wing. I don't think I have any particular right wing views. There are kind of some issues where I will kind of draw on some of my own kind of family experience and adopt positions on kind of crime and law and order, for example, which some people might perceive to be as on the right of the party. And, you know, I'm very comfortable with kind of patriotism, tradition, the monarchy, those sorts of things. But generally speaking, I mean, I would describe myself as a moderniser, and that means, you know, by definition, not kind of being stuck in the past. And I find the labels unhelpful. I mean, you know, I go and do like talks to schools in my constituency now on like, you know, people who are kind of in sixth form or, you know, going to university or onto college. You know, they don't really remember Tony Blair and Gordon Brown. This is kind of like someone asking me about Harold Wilson or the early years of Mrs. Thatcher. You know, I was alive, but I don't remember any of it. And I think sometimes the Labour Party is a bit guilty of kind of presenting the debate about the future as if it's between two competing visions of the past rather than kind of assessing where we are. And similarly, you know, I'm very proud of what New Labour achieved in government, and I felt the direct benefit of that Labour government. We'll always defend Labour's record, but there were things that I was not uncomfortable with. I mean, I alluded to it a bit. I mean, you know, Iraq I was opposed to, as lots of us were. And on tuition fees, it wasn't just about breaking the manifesto commitment. I think New Labour got far too caught up with marketisation of public services and a kind of a philosophical belief that, you know, if you set services up to compete, that competition will lead to a kind of public service improvement. And there wasn't actually a lot of evidence to support that. And sometimes you end up generating kind of wasted resources and energies when you kind of set up that kind of contestable kind of structure. But, you know, apart from that, I mean, I still, as I say, I mean, I think New Labour in government lifted you know, a huge number of people out of poverty, children and pensioners, rebuilt schools and hospitals, introduced new social rights, employment protections. It was a really reforming, radical government, and I'm, you know, very proud of it. But yeah, it goes back to the earlier point I think I made about culture, which is, you know, instead of kind of slapping labels on each other and kind of just trying to paint us as kind of bogeymen, I mean, the key thing is I just want Labour to win again. And I'm a bit kind of exhausted with the Labour Party having to relearn lessons that we seem to have learned in the past and then forgotten. You know, particularly the starting point is you've got to meet the voters where they are, and you've got to earn their trust and support. Otherwise, you don't get to do anything. And it's no good people kind of pointing to the 2017 and 2019 manifestos and saying how good they are, or the 2015 and 2010 manifestos, that matter. You know, we lost those elections. So you have to, and we didn't get to do any of it. And there's loads of stuff in all four of those manifestos that I would have liked to see happen, but we didn't get to do any of it because we lost. So I desperately want Labour to win again. I want there to be a Labour government again. I want to be in a Labour government. And I know that this country has always been better served by Labour governments than Tory governments, but we've all got to kind of pull together and start listening a bit more to the voters and helping that to inform our thinking, so we've got a chance of leading the country.
So I think that brings us nicely onto the thing where we really want to talk to you about, which is your shadow ministerial role. You don't really shadow anyone. You have a unique brief, which is, I hope I've got this right, the shadow secretary for state for child poverty, but shouldn't it be against child poverty?
Yeah, it's funny. I always describe myself as the shadow child poverty secretary and lose the four bit. We're very much not in favour of child poverty and very much in favour of getting rid of it. It's an interesting role that Keir's given me, because it is, like you say, I'm not directly shadowing a government department or a secretary of state, and it's a cross-cutting role. And I think one of the things that I'm kind of looking at, you know, as part of my role and also as part of the policy review that Annalisa Dodds is leading as party chair, is trying to join the dots on thinking about poverty. Because if you're serious about ending child poverty, and we are, you know, that's about education and making sure that children get the very best start in life. It's about housing, making sure they've got somewhere decent to live. It's about employment and making sure that parents have got decent work and decent incomes that give them, you know, a decent standard of life. It's about access to kind of culture and sport and the sorts of opportunities that kids from wealthier backgrounds get. So it's really quite cross-cutting. And so I'm trying to think about this in the broadest sense. You know, we've hit the ground running. This weekend, we just published some research that showed that not only is child poverty squandering people's lives and life opportunities, we're also squandering money in the process. It's costing our country £38 billion, both in terms of spending money on the symptoms of poverty, but also lost earnings, lost tax revenues. It all adds up. What I would like to do, and what we've committed to, you know, doing over the weekend, I mean, Keir is going to treat this as a kind of personal priority, and there'll be a child poverty reduction unit in Number 10. And that's going to be a really important tool, because if we're serious about ending child poverty, we've got to pull every department in the right direction. And that's how I work across the shadow cabinet. So, you know, I've got a great relationship with colleagues across the shadow cabinet who are doing really important work in this area. And it's all beginning to kind of join up. And that's from the stuff that Kate Green's announced on the Children's Recovery Plan, the work that Johnny Reynolds has been doing to try and stop the universal credit uplift from being cut, Angela Rayner and Andy McDonald's work about, you know, the future of work and the dignity of work. You know, this is all really, really crucial if we're going to end child poverty. And that's what the next Labour government will do.
One thing that particularly caught our eye at the podcast was your discussion of 10 by 10 pledges in your Labour List article, your recent Labour List article. Could you tell us a little bit more about that? How many of those 10 by 10 pledges did you do in your childhood? And why did you choose those particular 10 pledges?
Yeah, so, I mean, my starting point for this was thinking about, you know, why is it that so many parents make quite significant financial sacrifices to send their kids to private schools? It's partly because they know they'll get small class sizes and close attention. But it is also because they know that they're not just buying that kind of focused education. they're buying access to a whole wider range of opportunities in terms of extracurricular drama, music, sport, that wider enrichment that they recognise and know from their own backgrounds and experiences are really important for both, not just for learning, but for life as well. And if it's good enough for them, it's good enough for everyone else. And what we want with 10 by 10 is to give every child in the country access to 10 enriching experiences by the age of 10. And there are a wide range of things. It includes playing an instrument, learning to swim, learning to ride a bike, competitive sport, drama, debating, camping, trips to museums and galleries, trips to the seaside and the countryside, counting them out in my head now, and going to, you know, going to a great local library. And they're all important in different ways. Looking down the kind of list, I think I've done most of them by the age of 10. I don't know if I've done debating, and I'll explain why that's important, but you know, I think these are the sorts of skills that give young people confidence and, you know, set them up really well. I mean, the thing about private schools is, you know, they kind of generate in their kids this kind of sense of self-belief and almost entitlement that when you grow up, you're going to be captains of industry, cabinet ministers, stars of screen and stage. And we should be no less ambitious for kids who go to state schools. And as I said to some students in one of my schools in my constituency just the other week, sometimes you do things and you do them and you enjoy them and you have no idea when they're going to come in handy. So one of the kids said to me, you know, where did you get your public speaking skills from? And I said it was school drama. And, you know, I was in every school play from the age of 5 to the age of 18. I did it because I loved it, not because it was, you know, a thing on my CV or a particular, I didn't think about it as a skill. I just did it because I loved it. And, you know, that's helped me to project my voice. It's helping my confidence. It helped me help to build resilience. So, you know, these are really important opportunities, and they're opportunities that are declining for young people. So since the Tories came to power, kids' participation in music has fallen by just over a third, by 36%, I think. Competitive sport in and out of school has gone down by 13%, which really surprised me, because you'd think that competitive sport is just something that every child does in every school, but no, it's gone down. And for drama and theatre, participation is down by 47%. So we've seen really big narrowing of childhood opportunities under the Tories, but it won't be affecting those kids at private schools. It will be affecting everyone else. And I picked debating as well in there, because one of the things about being an MP and a bit of our job that doesn't get as much airtime is, you know, we spend a lot of time advocating for people and helping people with individual problems. And I think that there are a load of people from quite working class disadvantaged backgrounds who have never been taught how to argue for themselves and to kind of stand up for themselves. And debating for me isn't just about teaching people the rules of debating and kind of and that kind of technical side of it. It is actually about people having the opportunity to hold their own in an argument and to kind of be confident about what they think and believe and stand up for themselves. And I think that's really important from a social justice point of view.
This is a role that not alone has, you know, you find very interesting, has a lot to do with your history, but it's actually a role that you want to work yourself out of when we're in government. You almost don't want to have this job in 10 years time, because we hopefully wouldn't have any child poverty. But, you know, say there's a general election, you know, in 6 weeks time, something strange happens and we win, huge jubilation, you get into, you know, you're in number 10, you're in the policy unit, you're in the cabinet. How do you know when you've been successful? What is the mark of success in your role? Hoping, of course, that we win the next general election.
Yes, that's one of the things that we're looking at the moment, which is what can we reasonably do in the fastest amount of time possible to make the most difference? Because when we were last in government, we had a pledge to halve child poverty by 2010 and end child poverty by 2020. There's effectively a 20-year time period. And we had a really good go. I mean, the financial crisis impacted a bit, but before 2010, we almost hit that target of halving child poverty. And the ambition itself was really important. And it's pretty galling that here we are just after 2020, when child poverty should be a thing of the past, and it's actually increasing. And there are more children in poverty now than there were before. So it's, and with the universal credit cut, we're looking at another 200,000 kids plunged into poverty. So yeah, we're kind of breaking this down and looking at kind of what we might pledge and what we might be able to achieve, because there are different measures of poverty as well. And one of the things that I find pretty startling is that the number of people living in destitution, as opposed to kind of relative poverty, and sort of destitution being one of the worst kind of experiences of kind of sleeping rough and, you know, being deprived of food and that kind of really awful gut-wrenching poverty. You know, you might kind of start there. In fact, you should start there to kind of make sure that no one is having to have that experience. But we want to do as much as possible, as fast as possible. And we want to look at all the levers we can pull to make that happen. But, you know, this is a big ambition and it's going to require working right across government. And my job is to make sure that by the time we get into government, we've got a plan ready to deliver.
Okay, so moving a little bit from talking about politics to talking about you as an individual, one of the things that we discuss quite a lot in this podcast is mental health. We're very concerned about our listeners' mental health, our own mental health, and what we can do to support ourselves. So I want to ask you, how did you cope with the mental health pressure of both having a high stress job, your cancer diagnosis recently, and also on top of all that, the global pandemic going on in the background?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I mean, I'm a pretty resilient person, and I tend to be quite an optimistic person, which is a good thing if you're a Labour MP. You need to remain optimistic. With the cancer diagnosis, I mean, that came as a real shock, and particularly the you know, the shock of getting a cancer diagnosis at the age of 38. But the thing that kind of kept me going throughout was that they were very clear that they caught it early. My prognosis was very good. And, you know, there are lots of people in my life who've got cancer far worse than I have. You know, there are very close relatives. I've lost the cancer in the past. So my kind of my outlook and attitude was, well, what have you got to complain about? You know, your situation is so much easier than lots of other people. You know, didn't have to have chemotherapy, didn't have to have radiotherapy. I had an operation to remove one of my kidneys. And now I have to make sure that I don't kind of get diabetes or kidney disease. So I have to kind of change certain aspects of my diet and lifestyle in terms of things like, you know, physical activity and sport and exercise. But all the way through, I mean, my mentality was, you know, it could be so much worse. And also, you know, cancer doesn't, there are no upsides to having cancer. So you've got to try and create some. So I kind of, with the time I had off, I was trying to kind of, you know, read books and do things that I wouldn't normally kind of do in terms of, you know, my relaxation. And also slightly frustrating having so much, because I'm a natural workaholic, so it's slightly frustrating having such significant period of time off work, but a big part of that being kind of pretty immobile on the sofa, so it's really annoying. And then I think we've all found the pandemic hard. I'm a naturally sociable person, so not interacting with people has been hard. I think going for walks and getting like clearing your head is really important. It's very important for me. I found actually that since I've come back, doing exercise and going to the gym for the first time in my life, I've actually found quite a good stress relief and quite fun in a way that I never expected, as someone who, like, I would absolutely say is not a natural gym person. So I've kind of been enjoying that. So I mean, that would be my sort of general advice, really. I mean, but I mean, I've always been a pretty resilient person. And I think that partly comes back to some of my upbringing and some of the kind of experiences I had as a kid. You know, my life is so much more secure and comfortable now than it was when I was growing up. So I've got a lot to be kind of happy about. And you have to just sometimes just remind yourself that things could be so much worse and be grateful for what you have.
Okay, so you said in one of your earlier answers that in your constituency, you go and you speak to young people about their experiences, about what you do. And to be honest, we ask everyone who comes on this podcast, you know, if you've got one piece of advice for young people or a young activist who wants to get involved, what would it be and why?
I think first and foremost, don't let anyone else stand in your way and never put ceilings on your own ambition. Because there'll be plenty of hurdles thrown in your way by life. Sometimes people throw hurdles in your way deliberately. Sometimes it's just through bad luck or chance or circumstance. But in the end, the only person who can stop you from achieving what you want to achieve is you. And you know, one of the things I kind of say when I visit local schools, I mean, I always kind of draw a comparison between myself and Jacob Rees-Mogg, because when I was first elected, you know, we were both on the Treasury Committee, and I remember looking across at Jacob, and Jacob's a good kind of character to pick out because, you know, people have generally heard of him. He is so obviously from a very privileged background. And in that sense, we could not be more chalk and cheese. I mean, he is born into effectively kind of aristocracy, very wealthy, very privileged, and has every kind of opportunity thrown at him from the moment he's born. You know, I was born into a completely different situation, grew up in poverty, experienced things that Jacob would never have to think about, like, you know, the lights going out when the electricity meter runs out and not having any money to put in the meter. You know, my granddad was in and out of prison when I was growing up, and, you know, when my mum was growing up. So life was pretty hard. And the reason I kind of point to Jacob is just kind of say to people, you know, we've arrived at the same destination, we've run the same course, but I've had to do the hurdles, whereas Jacob's had a sprint. And in the end, I think it's kind of made me a stronger politician, or to kind of stick with the analogy, a stronger athlete in a sense, because when life throws hurdles at you, you kind of have to jump and you have to overcome them, and that makes you stronger. Sometimes, as you know, it's been a long time since I've done hurdles, but you know, you find when you do hurdles, there'll be times when you don't succeed and you get knocked down. You have to pick yourself up and dust yourself down. But then, you know, looking back on my childhood, although there were experiences I had that I wouldn't wish on any child, it has given me resilience and it has made me a stronger person. So that's where I think, especially for kind of people listening who do not come from privileged backgrounds and might think that politics isn't for them, that you can't have a career in politics or that you can't stand for elected office, and that it's all kind of dominated by people from very similar backgrounds. You know, the moment you think that you can't do it, you've already surrendered and you've put a limit in your own way before anyone else has even tried to. And you have to just kind of persevere and keep going, and then you'll succeed. And that's kind of been my kind of philosophy, really. And that's kind of the way I've approached kind of life and politics.
That was so nice. You like have a little motivational montage at the end of our episode. So you should like do a little like, where well, says believe what, in yourself.
You can see it, your listeners won't see it, but on the wall in my office behind me is a picture of Tessa Jowell. And one of the reasons Tessa's on there is not just because she was very good to me when I was a candidate and, you know, very inspirational. I just thought, I mean, she's a really good example of someone who just did not let things get in her way. And obviously when she was diagnosed with her brain tumor, and there was a lot of reflect, you know, she kind of carried on in a typically determined way. Also that, you know, after she died as well, there was such a reflection on her kind of life and legacy. But I kind of keep her on the wall as a reminder that, because there are plenty of days in politics where you get frustrated. Sometimes they're little things, sometimes they're big things. But Tessa's example was always about kind of knocking down those barriers and just cracking on and getting things done and achieving things and making a difference. So I think that's the other thing, like have role models, have people that you can kind of aspire to and look up to and kind of that motivate you and keep you going. And though they may be famous people, they may be people who are just your friends and family, but, you know, just kind of having a bit, sometimes you need a bit of motivation, especially in politics. This is hard graft, and the hardest challenge for Labour is going to be winning a general election. It's easy to lose power. It's really hard to get there in the first place. So we need all of that resilience, drive and determination we can get.
Do you think we can win?
I really do. Yeah, for a number of reasons. I mean, I think Keir is the best candidate for Prime Minister fielded by any party since 2010, at least. Very, very strongly believe that in terms of his integrity, his experience. I think that we've got a real opportunity with Keir. I think that the sheen is beginning to come off of Boris, and his popularity is beginning to wane and the polls are beginning to narrow. I wouldn't overstate that because there's no room for complacency when he's been shifting the dial week in, week out. But, you know, the Labour Party has never lost five elections in a row. And, you know, I don't want to be part of a shadow cabinet that has a fifth defeat. And you look at the challenges facing the country, and, you know, especially when you think about my brief and child poverty, you know, why, how on earth, it really frustrates when people say like, oh, well, it's so difficult. Yeah, it's going to take two terms, isn't it? It's like, well, if you conceded you've lost the next general election, then you're going to make it happen. You have to have the ambition and the will and the drive to win. But the Labour Party, and this is kind of a collective challenge, we've all got to do what it takes to win. And that means really big fundamental change in the Labour Party, in our mindset, our outlook, our policies. And we've got to anchor our politics where the voters are and kind of take them with us, and not keep on being angry with the public for not voting for us. We've got to be a bit more persuasive than that. And like, I totally understand why people kind of have like mugs and badges saying, don't blame me, I voted Labour. I feel like that some days too. But there's also sometimes, I think, a kind of an arrogance in that position, which the voters pick up on and notice, because it basically says, oh, we've been right for 11 years and the voters have been wrong. But it's hard. I mean, defeats are always hard, but we've just got to get back to where the voters are and kind of take them with us. And I really think we can do it. But we've got a lot of work to do and not a lot of time. So next week's conference, which I'm really looking forward to, is a really important opportunity. We really missed not having a conference last year. I think Keir really missed not having that big set piece speech in front of an audience to lay out who he is, what he stands for, and why he wants to lead our country. So I think that is very much going to be where his speech is pitched next week. Alongside Keir, you've got others of us in the shadow cabinet who will be kind of setting out our stalls, and Rachel Reeves' speech as shadow chancellor is also going to be particularly important, because we struggle with economic credibility and being trusted with people's money. And then there'll be a very lively fringe, there'll be very lively debates on conference floor. No doubt there are going to be very lively debates about our rules and procedures, and there will be some lively debate about our policy. But I'm really looking forward to it, and I think there'll be a great atmosphere in Brighton, because I think people are going to be really happy to be back together again. So I hope that I survive without COVID long enough to get there.
We all hope that. I think everyone listening hopes that at the minute. We will definitely be there. The left wingers will be there. We're very, very excited. We are, although we are called the left wingers, we are actually a lot more than people who just get together and whinge. We do all stand for elections. And as there seems to be a common misconception among guests that come on our show, we do things as well. It's just the left doers wasn't really that great a name, really. So
I think left wingers is a perfectly good podcast title. We are allowed to whinge a bit. We're the Labour Party. We always like whinging, but we've got to get back to winning. And maybe after the next general election, you can rename the podcast Left Winners.
Maybe.
We will do that. We will do that if we win. I will put all my efforts into winning the next general election. And if that happens, huge. It'll be huge.
It'll be huge. It's going to be
massive
great.
Rebrand. It's going to be amazing.
Conference?
For sure. Have to go. It's been ages. Yeah. It's been ages. It's not, I prefer Liverpool to Brighton, but it would be dead exciting.
I love Brighton. I've got a real soft spot for Brighton. I think it's I like being by the seaside.
Wes Streeting, thank you so much for coming on. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
You're very welcome. Nice to see you both.
Unfortunately, that's all we have time for today. Thank you so much to Wes for agreeing to come on and talk to us.
Thank you to you, our listeners, for tuning into this podcast. If you'd like to hear more from us, you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram, or like us on Facebook.
And don't forget to tell your friends about us. It's the main way we grow this podcast.
Keep whinging, and we'll see you at Labour Conference.